for Yoshua ben Rachel, who is undergoing surgery, I think this afternoon, heart surgery. So, should be successful. He should have a refuah shlema. We are in Perek Chavei, chapter 25. We are in Avigail's deterrent for David. We know what happened. After the death of Shmuel, David moved down to Midbar Paran, an area in the south near Egypt. We discussed why he moved down there. His men have been hanging out with Nabal's shepherds, taking care of them, protecting them. And at the end of the season, David expects some help from Nabal. This is the time of the shearing. It's a time when Nabal provides a feast for the shepherds. And instead, Nabal refuses and is very rude, specifically in his refusal. David goes on the warpath. We talked about what moves David to have that kind of a reaction. Abigail finds out. We talked last time about how the youths who work for the family, whether for Nabal or for her, know to go to her, and she has apparently a practiced routine such that she is ready to move right into action. She's done this before. And clean up the mess that Nabal made. She sends this great big gift to David. She follows behind the gift. She hears David's intentions. She hears David say, "I am going to eradicate everything." And then she meets him. One note from last time, Susan had asked a question. We were talking about how Abigail is seen rabbinically as this very righteous person. We said that in the beginning of chapter 25, I see your hand, Ricky, but I'm going through the introduction first. We said that in the beginning of chapter 25, she was already portrayed as a person of great insight, and throughout her speech that we're going to learn today, we see elements of her righteousness in different ways that we're going to highlight. I talked about how the rabbis expand upon her righteousness. They talk about her as one of the seven biblical prophetesses. They list her or her residence in Gan Eden along with the most righteous people. But one particular note that we had was when we looked at the gift that was sent, the gift that she sent, in chapter 25, sentence 18, it said that she sent Chamesh Tzon Asuyot, which we said you could generally translate as five prepared sheep or perhaps five stuffed sheep. But the Medrash, which we saw from the Gemara in Chulin, said it means five tithed sheep, because when you shear the sheep, you're supposed to give some of the wool to the Kohanim, right? This is all familiar to people. This isn't coming out of nowhere. Okay. So, Susan asked about that interpretation of the word asuyot to mean tithed, and whether we have a parallel to that anywhere in Tanakh. And I was thinking of something, couldn't figure out what I was thinking of, but if you look on your sheet at source number one, I gave you a reference that may be relevant. First of all, I gave you a reference to Bereshit chapter 18, sentence 7, which just shows you that the word la'asot, or the root of it, ayin sin hey, usually simply means to prepare. That specific example is from the preparations for the three visitors to Avraham and Sarah's tent, where they take the cattle and vayimaher la'asos oso. He gives the cattle to Yishmael to prepare, and Yishmael prepares it. Right here, la'asot oso. La'asot, hang on. La'asot does not mean to create. La'asot means to prepare. And that's the simple read. That's pshat here as well. However, Shmuel Beis is what I wanted you to see. Shmuel Beis, chapter 19, sentence 25. And this is regarding Mephibosheth, the son of Yehonatan. We're not going to meet him for a while yet. Mephibosheth ben Shaul, not Mephibosheth ben Yehonatan, two different people. Mephibosheth ben Shaul, who is going to have an audience with David. And the text there says, Mephibosheth ben Shaul, yarad likras hamelech. He descended to go greet the king. Velo asa raglav, velo asa sefamo. So, you could read that as to prepare, but it's more than just to prepare. It's to make something right. It's litakein, as Rashi says. He didn't fix up his legs. He didn't fix up his beard. He didn't launder his clothing from the time that the king had gone into exile because of Avshalom. My point here is just to say that the word asa can mean more than to prepare. It can mean to make things right. And that's what I think the Gemara is doing here with Asuyot, is it's saying the sheep are being made right. That's possibly a basis for this drush. Okay, I saw Ricky and Janine. Ricky, what were you going to say?
Two questions, if I may. First of all, were you positive for COVID?
Yeah, that was days ago. That's old news.
Okay. The other question is, when you were talking about the voice going to help Yavad and all that, it occurred to me that David sent the voice to help Natal and then to sort of expect something in return. Or did the voice, well, the man just go down there?
What's the boys piece here? I don't understand what you mean when you refer to boys.
The men who went and then they helped and protected.
You're talking about David's men who were with the shepherds and who took care of them.
Right. So yeah. Did David tell them, instruct them to help out?
No. This is what they're doing while they're out there in the desert, is they're looking after Naval's shepherds. Yeah. I heard, yes, they're looking after Naval's shepherds. Yeah.
What?
I'm sorry?
Why would David's men looking after the shepherds?
I think that it's on one level an act of chesed. In other words, their existence right now is as fugitives from Shaul, right? They're on the run. For a long time, how long we don't know, they were in the area of Hebron. Now they have fled entirely from Shaul's area, and they have nothing to do. They're just hiding from Shaul, knowing that Shaul is after David trying to kill him. So while they're there, there are these shepherds in the area with animals that are vulnerable animals, and so they take care of them, they look after them, and yes, I think there's an expectation, we're doing something nice for you, hopefully you will reciprocate, but there's no agreement. There's no contract, Naval has never said I'm going to pay them. That's the idea.
Any indication, I lost my train of thought, is there any indication that David had his people near Naval's property, that he was already had in mind to ask him for help?
I'm sure he had in mind to ask him for help. David's own words said that, right? What we saw at the end last week in chapter 25, when he made his speech, which Abigail might have overheard, depending on how you read the psukim, we saw two different ways to see it. But David said in Pasuk Chaf Aleph, sentence 21, "Ach la sheker shamarti es kol asher lazeh bamidbar." You know, I thought he would do the right thing. Recognize we invested in helping him and in protecting him. He needed our help. They would have suffered without us. As Naval's own man said, they were a wall of protection. I would have expected something. We discussed a couple of weeks ago the fact that technically David doesn't have a right to expect this. The fact that there was no agreement. And Naval is within his rights to say, that was your decision. You never talked to me about it. I never agreed to pay you anything. But keep in mind, Naval's reaction goes beyond that. Naval doesn't say, who is this person who wants to be paid? We never had an agreement. Naval says, this upstart who claims to be king? There are lots of upstarts. Like, that had nothing to do with anything. That was just a gratuitous insult. That's where he gets into trouble.
My question is really about the chronology, about was David around there because he already had him in mind in the future, or was it just happened to be there, found out his men were helpful, and said, okay, well, let me help us.
Go back a step. David is in Paran for the reasons we outlined in the beginning of this chapter. whether that's to flee from Shaul, because without Shmuel there, Shaul is more dangerous, whether it's to get out of the way of all the people who are mourning and grieving and want to visit Ramah, and he's worried that that will lead to him being found, whether it's because David had wanted to be near Shmuel before, now he has no reason to be near him. We gave a lot of explanations. It's not that he went to Paran to seek out Nabal and get his help. That's not what's going on. He's fleeing to Paran for the reasons that we gave. He ends up in Paran. He finds a way to help. Presumably, if he had been in some other part of the Negev or some other part, some other area where there were other people grazing their animals, they would have helped those. It wasn't about seeking Naval's help per se. Okay. Janine, you were going to talk about Asuyot?
Yeah, isn't, I was going to look it up and I forgot. Isn't it mentioned like when Rivka prepared the lamb for Yitzchak, saying that it was Yaakov? Was the word that Shorish used there also? It sounds like a prepared meal. I was going to look up and I forgot.
So it's used a lot. It's used a lot. The question is really, can you take it to mean more than just preparation, but taking something and making it right? Making it just right in the way that is associated with, you know, with tithing something. That's really what I think you know, Susan's pointed to, and what I felt you could see in the pasuk with Mephibosheth. It's entirely possible, and I think you're right that it is used when we're dealing with you know, with that gift. Yeah, I'll just pull out the Tanakh. Where we're dealing with the food that she gives to Yaakov to give to Yitzchak. Let's see. Yeah, I think so. I'm not finding the pasuk right now, but I think it says, Asher asata biyad Yaakov bina, as I recall.
Maybe just cooked it to perfection. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I guess making it right
could
also mean
but that's the
presenting it.
Yeah. Okay. So let's get back to Abigail's speech, because that's our focus. So her speech is a little bit hard to parse, because she says a lot of things and seems to go back on herself a little bit. But I think you can more or less break it down into four sections. The first section of her speech is a statement of, my family is in the wrong. David, we know we messed up. Second part of her speech is, you should know, David, God saved you from acting on your anger. You were going to do something bad, Hashem has saved you from that. Third part will be a bracha for David, a blessing for David, which will also include some rebuke for David. And then the last part of it will be a statement of, when you ascend the throne, you will be better off for not having acted on your anger, and remember me when that happens. Those are the four parts. We're not getting through all four parts today. Let's not kid ourselves. But we'll get through what we can get through. By the way, I just remembered, this week we have class. Obviously, we're here today. Next week we have as well, God willing. The following Thursday, 2 weeks from today, I won't be available. So that'll be Thursday the 26th. We won't have class. My son will be graduating YU that day, God willing.
So,
thank you. So let's look at the first part.
It's graduating for what?
YU, Yeshiva University. So, part one of the speech is sentences 23 to 25. That's where she says, my family is in the wrong. Let's take a look. Vatera Avigail es David. Avigail saw David, and remember, she may have heard what he just told his men. That's one view. Or she didn't, but she knew what was going to happen anyway. Vatamaher, she rushed. Vatered me'al hachamor, she descended from the donkey. There's a temptation here to see a parallel with Yitzchak coming and Rivka coming into to Yitzchak and falling from the camel. Not so sure, but it sounds like it. But she She descends from the donkey. Vatipola pe David al paneha. She falls on her face on the ground in front of David. No mistaking that stance, right? It's a stance of beseeching. Vatishtachu aretz. She bows down to the ground. Vatipol al raglav, and she falls at his feet. Vatomer, and she said, Bi ani adoni he'avon. She says, my master, the sin is mine. Vatadaberna amascha be'oznecha ushma es divrei amasecha. But please, let me, your maidservant, speak in your ear, listen to the words of your maidservant. Al na yasim adoni es libo el ish hablial hazeh al naval. My master, don't let your heart go to, don't pay attention to, this man who is Bilial. Bilial is a term we use normally to mean wicked. Literally, Bilial means without worth. Bilial, of no value. This man of no value. Al Naval, ki kishmo kein hu. He is like his name. Naval shemo, unvala imo. His name is Naval. We talked about this in the beginning of the chapter. The reference in his name. His name is Naval, disgusting, repellent, rotting. And that's what's with him. Vani amascha lo ra'isi es narei adoni asher shalachta. And I didn't see the youths you sent. You sent these youths to ask for help. I didn't know anything about it. That's the opening part of her speech. Now, right off the bat, you have a problem. Because she says, I am at fault. I am guilty. In sentence 24, I'm not taking questions yet. I want to just go through this first, and then I'll take questions. In sentence 24, she says, the guilt is with me. But then in sentence 25, she says, I didn't know anything. So, which is it? So, three different approaches in the commentators. Rashi and Ralbag say, she didn't mean it. She didn't really mean that she was guilty. Rashi says, if you take a look at source number 2 on your sheet, Mitchila amra kach kedei sheyate ozen lidvareha. She began by saying this just to get his attention so that he would listen to her, right? When someone is angry, your best shot at getting them to listen is by saying, I'm sorry. So she says, I'm sorry. Ulasof amra lo ha'emes. And then later on, she gets around to explaining, I didn't know, it was my husband, and he's a rotten guy, and so on and so on. That's one approach. That's Rashi Ralbag. Second idea is she doesn't mean what you think she means. And I think this is pshat in the sentence. When she says, be in me, she really means banu, in us. The sin is with my family. Our family has guilt. Mitzudat David is like that. Alternatively, Abarbanel has an interesting idea. The word that's used in the Hebrew for sin or for guilt is avon. So he says avon can mean punishment, suffering, blame like harm. In other words, the punishment is upon us. He points out, Abarbanel points this out, in Eicha, chapter 5, sentence 7, there's a pasuk, Avono Sehem Savalnu. We have suffered their Avon. So he reads that as Avon, meaning punishment. We have taken the punishment of others. I'm not so sure that's the only way to read that pasuk in Eicha, but it's another approach. Either she didn't mean it, or she doesn't mean what you think she means when she says it, but Malbim throws in this wild curveball. It comes in out of nowhere. I would normally look at this and say, let me not even bring this, because no one's going to know what to do with it. But it fits in very well with something that we said last week. Take a look at source number 3. Malbim says, she says, Hine naval ze ka'ayin nechshav. This naval, he's worthless. He's like a nothing. Yeshlo osher unchasim. He's got all this wealth. He has all these assets. V'lo hishlito elokim lachol mimenu. And God never empowered him to eat from what he has. As I added in the brackets, he's such a stingy person, he's not willing to enjoy what he has. Umashanoda b'shem le'ish shua hu al yadi. He is known as somebody who is generous because of me. I'm the one who gives out his wealth. V'lulei ha'yisi ishto lo haya adoni sholayach elav. If I were not his wife, you would never have sent him to him for help. V'imkein ikar ha'avon bi. It's my fault, she says, that all of this happened, because I gave him a reputation that's better than he deserved. I am the one who was giving out his assets, and when you sent your men, they came to him instead of coming to me. It completely doesn't fit the story, meaning we've made no reference in this story to Avigail giving out Naval's wealth, or to David knowing anything about Avigail or anybody giving out Naval's wealth. It's a total left-field comment. However, it fits with what we said last week about her saving Naval in the past. It feels a little bit like blaming the victim, like you're at fault for correcting his wrongs, you know? But it also doesn't fit with the idea that Naval is known as a bad person for his deeds, which you saw in the beginning of the Perek, right? The idea that he's known as a bad guy. Nonetheless, it's a very interesting read that Malbim is bringing into this. So, three different approaches. Either she was just saying this to get David's attention, or she was saying, we are guilty, not I am guilty. Add in the idea of Avon, Onesh, fine. Or, no, she really means it. It's my fault all of this, you know, played out because people think they can get help from him because I offer it. And that's why this came about. One last note, and then I know there are questions. But I wanted to just note one other thing here. and that is, in sentence 25, she says about Naval, right? He's so disgusting, and he has disgusting with him, and all of that. Look at what Malbim says here in source number 4. What she's trying to say to David is that he's not worth your time. That's what she's trying to say. Habizayon lo yiyeh rak me'ish nichbad ubein hashavim. He says, people feel ashamed, embarrassed, if they're mocked by somebody who is someone of status, or at least somebody who's an equal. Lo me'ish pachos v'nikle, not when it comes from some lower person, some disgraced person. Shaleichu shulebizyo, no. No one cares about what he says. V'hine naval zehu nikle b'ine abrios. This naval, no one takes him seriously. Everybody mocks him. Ki Naval Shemo. His name is Naval, and I think what he's doing is he's saying what Radak's father said before. When Radak's father said that his name is not Naval from birth, we said this in the beginning of the chapter, he said that Naval was a nickname. What she's saying is, you know, everybody calls him Naval, and it fits. That's the idea. And so, don't get involved with him. Don't feel bad about what he said about you. He's a nobody and not worthy of your concern. That's the idea. Clear? You know, no one likes to read someone say this about their spouse, but at the same time, this is, you know, there's a history here for sure. Okay, I saw a lot of hands. I hope people, you know, were able to keep in mind what they were thinking, even as they also heard what I was saying. Let's see. Claudette.
I'm leaning towards Malbim, because I was thinking that she was saying, oh, I feel responsible, because I always intercept all these things, get it done, and this one passed by me. You know, mm-hmm. I didn't get the chance to intercept the young man that was coming. So she's saying, I feel responsible for what is going on. Mm-hmm. She knows the man she's married to.
Yeah. Could be. It could be. It's just demands more than you see in the psukim. I would like to have found a medrash that said what Malbim is saying here, but I didn't. I did not see any. Sandra.
I was just wondering, how did Abigail get access? After all, he was a somebody. On the one hand, he's worried about Shaul or Shaul's people killing him. She was or his men. How did she gain access? How,
right.
How
now, and the answer is go back to what we read last week. If you go back to sentences 19 and 20, she sends the gift. You see that?
Yes.
She sends the gift ahead of her. Sentence 20, she's riding on a donkey, and David and his men are riding towards her. They're meeting, you know, head to head on this path by the mountain. That's how. The gift gets there first. David and his men are admiring the gift, and then she rides up as the matron who sent the gift. That's how. No. Okay, Susan.
When we were talking about her putting down her husband,
yeah.
In those days, correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm doing from what I've learned in the book, that women married for financial reasons. They didn't marry in those days for love. They married for, support, you know, to be taken, so they wouldn't be out in the streets.
Right, that was all last week's discussion. I don't remember if you were there. But that was what we talked about.
But I'm saying this explains why she feels safe to badmouth him.
Oh.
Like, because her badmouthing him, she doesn't care about him. She's just stuck. So
right. Excuse me. The question is always how far you go with this. Because on the one hand, it really does seem black and white. And it has seemed black and white since the beginning of the chapter said, he's a bad guy of bad deeds and she is amazing. Like, how much more do you want to say to show? He is not worthy of her. There is no emotional bond whatsoever. However, they ended up getting married in the first place. Arranged marriage, not arranged marriage, solely about money, family, who knows? It's such a mismatch that it makes sense to say that. The only thing that keeps, the only thing that keeps taking me back from that is the beginning of this Sefer. You may remember when we learned about Elkanah and Hannah and Penina, and we said that Penina tormented Hannah for her inability to have children. And we had two different views as to why Penina was doing this to Hannah. One view was that Penina was doing this out of jealousy, because even though Penina had the kids and Hannah didn't, Penina had the love of her husband, and the husband was concerned for her. And the text said what would happen was he would try to comfort Hannah, and Penina would aggravate her, cause and effect. He saw that she got the attention. She saw that Hannah got the attention, and she said, I'm gonna lash out against Hannah. That was one read. The other read was that she was doing it in order to get Hannah to daven, in order that Hannah should have a child. And we asked at the time, like, what motivates you to take this second view? And one answer that was given, I think it was the Maharsha, was that you can't believe that a righteous man like Elkanah and a righteous woman like Hannah are coexisting in a marriage with someone who would be so evil, like what Penina is doing to Hannah, torturing her and making her suffer for her childlessness. So on the one hand, I'm telling you, black and white, Nabal is awful, Abigail is wonderful, and here they are in a marriage. And on the other hand, I'm telling you, no, there's no way that that happens. That's the problem.
One of the beautiful things about our Tanakh, our Torah, too, is we're honest. She has foibles. Nobody's perfect. Nobody's real. She is human, and she's living with the Mar, and she just, for whatever reason, has a ability to say bad things about her husband because she's human and she suffered from it.
Maybe. I'm not denying that it's a possibility. I'm still reticent. That's what I'm saying. Okay. So let's go a little further. We've now seen her opening salvo, the apology, the explanation about Nabal, the statement of, he's beneath your notice, don't waste your time on him. Her second phase is just one sentence. Sentence 26. Ve'ata Adoni, and now my master. Chai Hashem, by the life of God. Ve'chei nafshecha, and your own life. Asher mena'acha Hashem mibo bedamim. God kept you from entering into blood. She's swearing. Hashem kept you from what sounds like bloodshed. V'Hoshea yadcha lach. The phrase V'Hoshea yadcha lach is a very odd turn of phrase. Not straightforward. But I think the way to read it is, God has saved you from coming into blood and from saving yourself with your hand. In other words, using force. I hope that's consistent with your translations. I think that's what it's saying. So she says to him, God saved you from doing that. Ve'ata, and now, yihyu chenaval oyevecha, v'amavakshim el Adoni ra'a. May all of your enemies be like naval, all those who seek to harm my master. So, two parts to this. The first part, God saved you from doing this. And the second part, the wish, may your enemies be like naval, which is really sort of, in a way, an introduction to her third part, which is going to be the bracha for David. It really fits in better there. But in terms of saying Hashem saved you from bloodshed, so the simple read is exactly that. God saved you from making a mistake. Take a look at Ralbag, please, in source number 5. The Amra im shivuasa, she said with her oath, right? Chei Hashem, chei nafshecha. She's acting like the result is already in. David has already decided, I'm not going to attack. She doesn't know that. Right? David has not yet said, okay, men, stand down. Nonetheless, she is talking as though it's a given. David isn't going to do anything to Naval. David isn't going to do anything to the household. Ach huma for some et slashik vayimna David mizeh achara piyus asher piyasa oso. Because she knew about David. People knew who David was. And again, this is always part of that debate that we have. Who knows what about David at this point? Do people know that David is supposed to be king? Do people know what's been going on between David and Shaul? Rabag assumes that David, defeater of Goliath, leader of Shaul's army, son-in-law of the king, is known. And therefore, what she's saying is, I know you're not going to do it. God stopped you from doing this, and that's a great thing. Abarbanel goes a step further in his discussion of this. Take a look. Source number 6. Shalom nimna am misas naval b'mikra. What she's trying to say is not just, I know you're not going to do it. But also, it didn't happen by chance that you were kept from doing this. Omi pa'as tachanunila fonecha, or because I pleaded with you. Avalo elokim bashamayim ratzavis hivev shalotimisehu. It's God's doing that you're not going to kill Naval. V'hu yisbarach haya hamoneya mimcha misaso lo ani. It's God who stopped you, not me. V'zeu chei Hashem v'chei nafshecha. That's why she swears by God. That's why she swears by David. God is the sole reason why you didn't do this. And if God is stopping you from doing it, that shows God doesn't want it to happen. Killing him is not good in God's eyes. God is weighing in, and that's why you're not carrying this out. Don't think, in other words, remember we went back to, go back to why David is doing this in the first place. One view for why David is doing it is that Naval is a Moreh B'Malchus. He's a rebel against the throne. It's not personal. This is what's supposed to happen if somebody is a rebel against the throne. Within this view of Abarbanel, she's defusing that charge. She's saying, if he were a rebel against the throne, then God would be on your side. The fact that God has arranged things such that you're not going to kill Naval shows that it's not warranted in the first place. That's the argument that Abigail is presenting according to Abarbanel. But now I want to show you something else entirely. Gemara and Megillah, source number 7. The Gemara takes this in a different direction. I am deliberately breaking the Gemara into parts. You're not going to see the entire thing in one piece. There are too many different components to this Gemara that relate to different parts of our story. And if we did the Gemara straight, it would become more confusing than helpful. So I'm taking, like you'll see one piece of this Gemara is in source number 7. Another piece of this Gemara we're going to come back to in source number 22. Not today, probably. But like we're going to see bits and pieces of this Gemara along the way. But look what she says to David in source number 7. Amrolo, she says to David, V'chidan in dine nefashos balayla. Do you deal with capital cases at night? We don't judge capital cases at night. It's nighttime right now. You're going to go attack him at night. Omar la, to which he replied, Mori b'malchusu. Nabal is a rebel against the throne. V'lo tzarech l'medayne. There's no need to judge him. Tosvot, the rabbinic commentary, he says, not that there's no need for a trial, but there's no need to try him by day. Amrlo, adayin shaul kayim v'lo yatza tivacha ba'olam. And to which she says, no, he's not a rebel against the throne. Like Abarbanel said, he's not a rebel against the throne. After all, not everybody knows that you're supposed to be king. And therefore, he is not a rebel against the throne at all. He doesn't qualify for that idea. Now, there's more to be said about how the Gemara reads this into the sentence. I'm not ready for the full piece of the Gemara yet about what she's talking about, but with what we will see eventually is that this Gemara is drawing on the word damim. The word for blood, I would have expected, would have been dam. The truth of the matter is that damim can also be used for blood. We find that numerous times in Chumash. Hang in there, Susan. The word damim can be used for the singular blood as well. Nonetheless, the Gemara is reading it into the word damim, meaning plural, bloods. And more than that, I'm not ready to say just yet. We're going to come back to it. Susan, and then Claudette.
Itself. Either God stopped David from sinning, or David wouldn't have done it on her own because she knew he wasn't the type to attack.
Oh, no. Sorry, let me clarify. Rabbah did not say that she was saying, I know David's nature, he wouldn't do this. I know David, he will accept when I apologize.
Oh, that's not okay.
Yeah, yeah. No, right, that's what he's saying. Yes, Claudette.
I always liked Abigail. Today I'm in love with Abigail. For one thing, I recognize a wise woman, because all of this talking and talking to David seems to me like a woman who is calming a man, who is calming a very angry man. You know, so she is going on and she's talking and he's just listening.
Yes.
So she will get him to the point where he will give up his mission of going after.
Well, it's for sure true that she's going on at length. That's for sure.
It's a wise woman. It's a wise woman.
Yes.
She knows what she's doing.
Yeah. Now, I hear that. Yes, Janine.
The fact that she knew that Naval's death would be averted, is this a source for saying that she was a Nevi'ah?
We'll get to that. The answer is maybe. We're going to talk about what her prophecies were. That's coming up in the next phase of her speech, but you could read that line as being prophetic. You could also read it as being insightful. You'll see. We have more to read about that, and then we'll understand more. I mean, I'll tell it to you because we're not going to get to it today. It's in the fourth part of her speech, but you could read it as a prophecy of, yeah, it would be very bad for you down the line if you had done this. And we're going to tie that into Bathsheba. But you could also read it as just basic insight. How are you going to be accepted as a legitimate judge and leader if when somebody angers you by refusing to help, your response is to execute them?
But she says, Shalom nimna'a mitat naval b'mikre. She's talking about a certainty. She's not saying, do you realize...
Oh, the idea that it's from Hashem. Sorry, the idea that it's from Hashem is her argument. And I don't think anybody reads it as nevuah. No, it's just her statement.
It sounds prophetic.
Maybe, but I don't usually... There are a few things in her speech that get identified as potentially prophetic. I'm not familiar with anyone who picks on that. I think they take that as just her statement. Sandy.
I'm just sort of going back to when she first throws herself on the floor, dismounts from the donkey. There's so much... I think that's a lot of detail for a good reason. And yet, unless somebody announced, oh, this is the wife of... it doesn't say that that's who she is in terms of the eyes of David, who we assume has never met her before.
So I think, I mean, the text is assuming that we figure it out, but I think that she, as the lady of the house and the one to whom all of these Na'arim answer, they are her Na'arim. Remember, we said that last week. Those, the ones who are delivering are hers. They indicate who she is. That's the way that I would look at it. So, in the second part of this sentence that we just read, she began her bracha to David. May your enemies be like Naval. So the simple read of that, and Radak says it, and Malbim says it, say that it means too weak to harm you. That your enemies should all be as weak as Naval is. He's not significant to you. Similarly, Abarbanel says, beneath your notice, unworthy of your efforts, that kind of thing. However, Rashi here, based on this Gemara in Megillah, gives us the first candidate for what her prophecy was. Did I not bring it on the sheet? I didn't bring it on the sheet. Okay, Rashi says I know why I didn't bring it, because it was the Gemara that we saw last week. It was on last week's sheet. I mentioned already last week, she has, according to this view in the Gemara, let me spell it out. When we read last week that she was one of the seven prophets, right, prophetesses. So I brought you the Gemara, which gives you two candidates for what her prophecy was. One was a statement about David dying in honor and with a gentle death, which we're going to come back to actually later on in this passage. The other explanation there is that she foretells the death of Naval. Naval is going to die before the end of this chapter, and she is foretelling it now and saying, your enemies should be like that. So that's the way Rashi reads this line, is that it's actually prophetic. May all your enemies meet the same fate that Naval is about to meet. We'll see that. We'll talk about his death eventually. We're not there yet. Okay, but that brings us to the third part of her speech, which is where she offers him, first of all, her gift, and number two, where she is going to give him brachot, blessings, and within that, a little bit of rebuke. That's going to take us sentence 27 through sentence 29. Ve'ata, she says, and now, ha-bracha hazos asher hevi shivchascha la'adoni. This bracha here meaning gift. This is not the only time in Tanakh when the word bracha means gift. I will tell you now something we're not going to finish with this week. It's going to have to come back to it, God willing, next week. And that is when Yaakov gives his bracha to Esav. He says, when he gives his gift to Esav, he says, Kachno es birchasi, accept my bracha. It's a loaded term there because of the bracha Yaakov and Esav. But nonetheless, accept my gift. The word bracha can mean gift. That's what she's saying here. This bracha, this gift that your maid has brought for my master, accept that. V'nitzna l'ne'arim ha'mishalachim b'raglei Adoni. It has been given to your youths, to your ne'arim, or it is given to the youths who are walking with my master. Radak says, This is a euphemism, to honor David. Meaning, she doesn't want to insult David by saying, I've given you the food you need. I gave it to the youths. It's a little bit more respectful. Sana lefesha amasecha. She then says, except, which means really, forgive, the sin of your maidservant, forgive me, even though she explained that she didn't know about it, right? It could be that this is just a nicety, or it's saying, as Abarbanel says, forgive me because this gift I'm giving you is insufficient, and it's not, you deserve so much more, whatever. Or forgive me for being so bold that I'm having this marathon conversation with you, Abarbanel says. However you read that. Ki aso yaseh Hashem ladoni bayis ne'eman. Hashem is going to give my master an enduring house. Ki milchamos Hashem adoni milcham. Because my master fights the battles of God. V'ra'alo simatzei v'cha miyamecha. No evil will be found in you, ever. V'yakam adam lirdofcha. A man rises to pursue you. Ulvakesh es nafshecha, to seek your life. V'hayasa nefesh adoni tzura b'tzura chayim eis Hashem alokecha. The soul of my master should be bound up in the bond of life with Hashem your God. And the life of your enemies, they should be slung in a slingshot. Okay, a lot to talk about here, that's for sure. So, first of all, she says, God will reward you with a bayit ne'eman, for fighting God's wars. Question, does she know that he's going to be king or not? Sounds like it, no?
Is she hinting that she would become his wife?
Not at that stage. Well, that we'll get to. But almost all commentators at this point in the story have accepted that people know Shmuel declared David to be the next king. Almost all commentators are in line with that. However, Radak offers you a holdout option. Bayis Ne'eman in source number 8. Kitargumo, like the Targum says, Malchu Kayama, an enduring monarchy. V'derech Nivua Amrazeh. There's another candidate for what a prophecy was. She said it as a prophecy. Kiyachas Misheva Nevios, Adas Razal. Because, as the sages say, she is one of the seven prophetesses. And then he says, V'yesh l'faresh k'yad devar nishma v'noda b'Yisrael, or you could explain everybody knew at this point. Everyone else just says everybody knew at this point, but Radak is holding out on what the prophecy could be. So she says to David, God is going to give you this enduring house. May you never do anything bad. Two ways to read that. Either this is a bracha, it's a blessing, may you always remain innocent, or it's a rebuke, it's an instruction, hey, remain innocent. Two different ways you could read it. Abarbanel reads it as may you remain innocent, this is a bracha, it's a blessing. You are going to be king, you're going to walk in God's ways, you're going to do nothing wrong. Radak is in this camp as well. And then Abarbanel says, if you take a look at source number 9, regarding this business of a man rising up against David, he says, she knows what happened in the cave with Shaul. Right? That whole business in the previous chapter, people know what happened. That David did not harm Shaul. So he says, Imeyos shekam adam l'rod fechul v'keshes nafshecha, even though somebody stood up to pursue you, somebody sought your life, meaning Shaul. That's who she's talking about. Ramza Bazel is Shaul. She hinted at Shaul. She doesn't say his name. Some suggest that that's in order to mock him. Mock Shaul. Like, I'm not even going to mention his name. So she's hinting at Shaul. Shehis giro biyadoho elokim ba'me'ara. That God gave Shaul into David's hands in the cave. V'la ratza David lishlamach yado bo. David didn't want to hurt him. L'fisha l'chafetz lehisgael b'dam b'nei Yisrael. He didn't want to corrupt himself by taking the blood of b'nei Yisrael. V'zeu v'ra'alo simatzei v'chami yamecha. That's the meaning of saying, evil will not be found in you ever. Even though someone rose against you, you would have been justified in killing him. Because everybody knew about what happened in the cave. So Abarbanel says, she's giving him a bracha saying, even when somebody stood up to kill you, you didn't kill him. May you always remain innocent. May you always do nothing wrong. Whereas, as I said, the other way to read it is it's a rebuke. Rashi and the Malbim read it as a rebuke. Rashi says, in source number 10, Lo na'elecha la'aso shalo kedin, lahotzi la'az al malchusecha. It would not be appropriate for you to do something that is against the law, causing gossip against your reign. If you were to do this, and this goes back to what she had said before, right? Hashem is keeping you from doing this wrong. It would be bad for you if you did it. So Rashi says, what she's saying here is, this would be bad for you. Don't tarnish your reputation. Malbim is even stronger. Take a look at number 11. Ein meharaoi shetisarev bein milchama osecha, milchama lechvodcha she'ena milchames mitzvah ochova. Rak mechemes reshus o avera. It's unworthy of you that you should mix into your wars a war that's just about honor. It's not a war where there's some kind of obligation on you. You have to fight, you know, the Canaanite nations. Or like, that's not what this is. This isn't Amalek. This is just discretion. I'm annoyed at what he did. I'm going to go back and do this to him. Not reading it at all as Moreid B'malchus, a rebel against the throne, and therefore a religious war at all, giving no credence to that read whatsoever. Saying, you're doing this as a personal thing. That's not right. It's unworthy of you. And so she says, Ra'alo simatzei b'cha miyamecha. Let wickedness not be found in you all your days. Sha'az yomru, because you know why. You know what people are going to say. Ki nilchamta kefi hamikre. Ke adam ha'ohev milchama lishpoch dam kefi sheyizdamein. Because people are going to say, the only reason he fought was because he was a bloodthirsty guy. And sometimes he fought a Goliath, right? Sometimes he was a general for show. And sometimes he was just angry because Naval wouldn't pay him. That's what people are going to say. You're just a vengeful person. So that's the warning that she's giving to David. Clear? Two different ways to read the passage. Bracha or warning. And that brings us to the most famous verse in this chapter, where she says to David, may your soul be bound in the bond of life. The souls of your enemies are slung in a sling. And this is a bracha, it's a blessing, with multiple possible reads. There are three reads that we're going to look at. The first read of this is, it's a very simple and very straightforward statement that Hashem should keep you safe, and Hashem should punish your enemies. Radak says it, I didn't bring it on the sheet just because the sheet was long enough, but Radak says it's a simple statement of, let God keep you safe from your enemies, and let God punish those enemies. Second approach is the Sifri that we saw last week, that I mentioned already earlier today, that it's her prophecy about David having a gentle death with honor. That's the second read. The third read, though, is that this is a prophecy about the next world. Take a look at source number 13, the Gemara in Shabbos. What happens when a person dies? Nishmasan shel tzadikim gnuzos tachas kisei hakavod. The souls of the righteous are stored under the divine throne. Shenamar v'isa nefesh adoni tzura b'tzura chayim, quoting our verse. V'shel rishayim zomamos v'holchos. The souls of the wicked are imprisoned, and they go along. Umalach echad omeid b'sof ha'olam, umalach acher omeid b'sof ha'olam. You have one malach, one angel at one end of the universe, the other malach at the other end of the universe, umekala'in nishmasan zelazeh. They catapult these souls from one to the other, as you see in the rest of the sentence, that they should be slung in this catapult. That's the idea. What in the world is that? What is the state of being slung back and forth? So this may be familiar to some of you who participated in a mini-series that I did at Beth Emeth in November 2019. I gave you a link in source number 16 for the recordings from that series where we discussed the basis in Torah for Jewish belief about life after death. One of my favorite mini-series. I really enjoyed that one. And then after that, there was a pandemic. But in the in that discussion that we had then, we talked about what this catapult idea is, and we gave two different explanations. One, the explanation that this is reincarnation, Gilgul, and the other that no, it means the souls are wandering around in limbo. If you take a look at source number 14, this is from the Radbaz, Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra, very, very important halachic authority, lived for a time in Cairo, lived for a time in Spain. I believe he was the Rebbe of Rabbi Yosef Karo at one point, who wrote the Shulchan Aruch. So, just reading my English translation of his responsum in source number 14. Question is put to him. The following midrash is hard for us to understand. The midrash says, the souls of the righteous and the souls of the wicked alike return, descend, and are buffeted about in the world. As it is written, the souls of your enemies be slung in the bowl of the sling. This is the opposite of our tradition. That's the questioner says, what do you mean the righteous? Right? You say the souls of the righteous are also going to go through that? Why would that be? Further, the proof brought, the pasuk, the verse that's brought, applies to the wicked one's soul. Why should the righteous one's soul be buffeted about? What is his source? So the questioner hears a medrash that says that everybody has to go through this limbo thing. And says, I don't understand. So here's his answer. Indeed, we find that Rabbi Eliezer, in the Gemara in source number 13, said the opposite. The souls of the righteous are stored under the divine throne. The souls of the wicked are the ones who get buffeted about. However, know that there are righteous people who receive as do the wicked in this matter, such as those who stumbled in a sin which mandates reincarnation until they fulfill the divine will according to his justice. He says, you could have somebody who was righteous, but they need to repair something. And for that, they have to endure coming back to this world. There are two theories of reincarnation. One theory is that it's a punishment. The other theory is that it's an opportunity. And what he's saying here, he's taking the view that it's an opportunity. They have a need to come back and fix something. And he quotes you a pasuk in Shmuel Beis, that God devises plans lest anyone be pushed away. Nobody should be pushed away. You have an opportunity to repair. Thus that medrash said that both the souls of the righteous which need this, and the souls of the wicked, return, descend, and are buffeted about in the world, hinting at what we have said. You follow? That's the idea. Is a reincarnation idea. As opposed to source number 15, I'm doing this a little quickly because we're going to run out of time, but the Maharal of Prague gave a different approach to what this limbo is. And I'm going to sum it up, but you can see the original in source number 15. He's commenting on that Gemara in Shabbos about the catapult. He says, people sin often because they go to extremes. We're supposed to follow moderation. The moderate path, golden mean, you know the whole discussion. So he says, people who go to extremes tend to make extreme mistakes. And that's when they get in trouble and they need to be punished. So the person who went to extremes will have no rest in the next world and will have to undergo this kind of limbo experience, wandering from one extreme to the other. That's the way that he takes the this idea of limbo. Maybe we'll talk about it a little bit more next week, because it's too good a topic to just, you know, race through and discard. I see three hands, but it's already 2:30, so what I'm going to do, God willing, I'm going to make a note of it in my notes here. We'll start next time with questions and comments and expansion about this concept, so write down whatever it was that you wanted to ask about, please, and we'll revisit. Okay?
Have a good
Thank you very much, everyone. Have a good Shabbos.